Between now and 2025, $1.5 trillion of commercial real estate needs to be refinanced, and this will force some to realize that they need to cut their losses and sell. We will continue to evaluate deals out there since now things are lining up to be somewhat of a bottom of the market. If you've entered in 2021 and middle of 2023, I'm sorry, you might be in a deal with floating debt or debt renewing and being part of this tidal wave. And that is where these issues are coming. Check above the link to the doom and gloom post that I was playing around with, see what kind of reaction I would get. That's the sensationalized news that's being put out there, right? To get people to click on these types of YouTubes and articles. But make no mistake, there's been a correction as much as 30% off of the peak. And now we are at this probable bottom, like I said, and it makes a great entry point for new investors to get in. What you're going to start to see are headlines put out like that. Now, as we move into 2024, a lot of investors, especially new ones out there, are stricken by fear and uncertainty. I've been investing since 2000, and I can tell you that feeling is always going to be there, and one can always find reasons not to invest. This is why we see many people who shoot themselves out of the deal and don't invest and revert back to traditional investments. I would say more than half of the people I talk to and have calls with, they want to get out of traditional investments, but I get it. Without the community around and other credit investors in your network, it's hard, right? But hey, financial freedom is not for everybody. If not, who would be doing all the jobs out there, getting our coffee, building our bridges, playing doctor and dentist? For those people, we know it's going to happen, right? 30, 40 more years of working that day job and never really getting access to these other tax strategies and accredited investor banking strategies that we teach folks. I'll put those links into the newsletter form. If your net worth is under $2 to $3 million, you've got to keep working your money to get over the sticking point and get to end game of what I always describe as $4 to $5 million net worth. For some of you guys who are older and past the financial overlay of having to raise the kids and send them to college, and your net worth is already over $4 to $5 million, you might have the luxury to take it easy and play it safe with some more traditional investments. Some of the higher net worth people in our family office group are doing a lot of T-bills because they can, right? They can just rock out at 5%, and that kind of puts more than enough food on the table that they don't have to work a traditional job. Check back on some of our past coaching calls, see where you are at, and get tuned in to what are the strategies based on where you are at in the wealth building journey. More specifically, what the heck is your net worth and what are the strategies you should be doing? I'll put the link in the newsletter there. Obviously, you're listening to a financial podcast to get up to that point. Your money needs to be working for you, and you need to get out there and lean in to this uncertainty and fear, but just do as much as you can stomach and diversify. Real estate's been my elevator to wealth, and I'm super passionate, and I like to help a lot of you guys learn. And I think that's where we're going to be going in today's podcast. Really going to get into the meat and potatoes of the syndication numbers, what to look for, reversion cap rates, rent increases per year. But I think you still need to mix it up to some extent with other value-add investments. It's not just about traditional investments. It's about finding those other investments out there, such as real estate, that'll give you the tax benefits and potential higher returns. But it's by unlocking these alternative investments, you unlock the tax benefits. A lot of people, it's pretty easy for them to cut their tax bill by just a quarter, maybe even a half. Now, I know what a lot of people are doing out there. It's tempting to pay off debt in this time of uncertainty, but remember your mindset during the good times. This is when you could really made significant gains if you're positioned right. And like I said, there's been a recent correction. Now would be a perfect time to get that bounce off the bottom. Don't just limiting yourself to paying off debt, or also you may not make sense to fund capital calls that come out. I've been doing some pay by the hour coaching calls where we look at your deal that you're in and say, hey, is this make sense for you to fund your capital call with the particular sponsor that you're working with? And every deal is specific, and it's only a one by one. Check out the last podcast we did with Troy Taylor going into that in more detail. For those of you new investors coming in now, like, diversification is the key. Investing's always going to have risks. If you don't, then be happy working your job for another 20, 30 years and get 5% with zero risk type of investments. Now, But with good cash flow from your assets, your net worth can grow over time, allowing you to enjoy the lifestyle along the journey. The key is to reach a point where your investments provide steady cash flow, allowing you to live comfortably. So today we are going to be going into the fourth section of the syndication due diligence for LP investors. We do this every third Saturday for those of you who sign up for our list and enjoy more from a passive investor side. So I think we could, if you were a general partner doing these deals, this section would probably take 8 hours to 16 hours. It would somewhat be a weekend seminar just to get the high level. But as passive investors, you are putting a lot of faith and trust into your general partnership. After all, they're the ones with the huge skin in the game, which is co-signing on the debt and putting up larger amounts of money as far as reputation risk. But the goal here, what we're going to be going through in this section is like, what are things on the real high level that the LP can do to ensure that they're just not going into a sucker deal? We're going to dig into more as we get into the cap rate section. A syndicator, operator, whatever you want to call them, pretty much say whatever they want on the pitch deck, saying that they're going to return 80%, 100%, 100%, a gazillion percent return in 5 years. However, it's all what are the assumptions that they're using to get to those numbers. We all play around with spreadsheets here. If you play around with a couple cells of the spreadsheet and we all know which ones those are, you can get whatever numbers you want at the end. But the hopes today is everybody leaves here understanding what exactly those cells are. Obviously, we're not going to give anybody spreadsheets here because it's just not in the scope of a passive investor, but to generally know what are those things that you're looking out on a pitch deck. So here are some helpful links, some crime, good ways to just verifying areas and stuff like that. I think that's the big thing as a passive investors. And this goes beyond the numbers is, am I investing in a good area? Although the business plan may be in an opportunity zone deal where you're letting the tax tail wag the dog in a bit, or in a very severely undervalued Class C, Class D property, and you may be looking for places really bad crime around there. But generally, like my investment thesis is to go into a little bit better neighborhoods because in tough times, it's those really bad areas are the ones that struggle. And at the end of the day, if you have a safe neighborhood with a good school district, it won't be the best school district, that's for sure. But if you have a good, stable Class B area, better, you should do all right. So a few definitions here that people will look at from a numbers perspective. Of course, these are the top line numbers that we're going to dig into. What are the drivers of these numbers? This is a hopes to get everybody to speed. So some investors will look at a couple of things, either IRR, internal rate of return, or return on investment, ROI. Sometimes they are very similar. Sometimes they can range. A same deal may be 14% IRR, but 20% return on investment per year. And people are like scratching their head, like, why is it so different? In a nutshell, and you guys can review this on your own time. So I'm going to give you a little bit different spin on this as we go through this section. IRR is essentially a time-weighted metric. So some of these deals may or may not have cash flow in it. And if you put cash flow in your underwriting, it will make the IRR go up, essentially. But then if you say that there's going to be like 5-6% cash flow in years 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then you exit at year 5, like I said, it'll make your IRR go up. But what if you don't have that, right? There's big ifs. There's always risks in investing. And you need to take that into account because a syndicator could just throw that on there and just make their numbers inflate. Or what some people will do is just raise extra capital to make giveaway artificial cash flow to prop up that IRR. So that's what makes things difficult, as you can see from a passive investor. And I think a good passive investors always take it with a grain of salt or understand the shades of gray here. I, for the most part, look at, this is just my style, is I look at return on investment first. What am I getting on like a 5 year period, per se? For those race car enthusiasts out there, you guys know cars are typically measured, I believe, on the quarter mile. And people would probably ask, why don't you measure it on a 100-yard dash or a 5-mile run? That's just how it is. And in terms of investing in these types of value add deals, They typically take anywhere from 3 to 6 years. So to compare apples to apples, that's why I personally always use like that 5-year metric just to compare things. And that's what makes passive investing, investing in general, difficult because you're trying to compare non-like unique investments. And this is what the average traditional investor is really difficult to overcome mentally, where you're comparing like Apple stock with Microsoft stock, and you're going to hold it in a very liquid arrangement, easy stock arrangement, very different than these elite liquid investments, such as real estate projects or venture capital projects, where they have different timelines and different business plans. I would say understand the difference between them, but don't get bogged down in the details. This isn't really the important stuff. This is the stuff that people, I think, talk about a lot, but it's real surface level of discussions. If you're more of a numbers guy, check out this video here. It does a little example of ways to manipulate the IRR, and you'll start to realize, wow, you can really fudge these numbers quite a bit. Now I see why Lane is just looking at the high level, for example, what the heck my return was in 5 years. And I don't really get too much involved in this IR stuff because it's manipulated, like I said. So you're probably asking, like, all right, I get it. I can see shades of gray. I'm not going to take everything as gospel. But what the heck is a good IR? Generally speaking, and markets go in market cycles, of course, but if you're seeing anything like 12 to 16% IR, that's pretty strong for a value add deal. 20% plus, now you're getting a little bit more heavier value add, more aggressive value add. And I think a common mistake, or at least I've seen in the last several years, is investors chase IRR, but they don't understand the concept of risk to reward. When the IRR is high, you're probably going into more of a riskier type of investment. And that is why the IRRs are super high. Or you're going into a newer syndicators deal where they are just throwing around numbers just to get people excited. And number one, from a syndicator operator's point of view, that's not really good business. We always try to sandbag people and lower expectations and try to beat it. I think that's just a bit better business marketing practice. Some people just throw stuff out there and say, yeah, we've done 30% IRRs. That's just not my style as an investor. I'd rather work with less flashy operators who show a little bit more reasonable returns. Maybe they can say, yeah, we've had a deal exit at 25, 33% IR, but more reasonably expected on these deals going forward, we expect to see 14 to 17%. Like I said, IRR is manipulated when you get that cash flow, and the cash flow is not always certain. So that's why I always look at more from a business level standpoint. What's the run in 5 years? And that's what I discuss here in this section. If I can almost double my money, which is 80 to 100% return in 5 years, that to me checks my IRR. And I'm not really, I think more sophisticated investors, more higher net worth investors, they care about investments more on a longer time horizon. What's happening on 3 year, 5 year, or more, maybe even 10 year time horizons, where newer, less sophisticated investors tend to be more month to month or quarter to quarter or year to year. And they focus in on more what's my cash flow coming back. And I point this out to new investors. And my hope is that investors just take note of it themselves. You may be a new investor and you still feel that way, but to know and understand that the long term, you're in it for more of the equity growth in the long term. However, you may have a small portion of your net worth in like the PEP fund, for example, generating $1,000 a month, whatever. For the most part, if you emulate what family offices do, they don't really care whether they're getting cash flow in the first several years or ever. It's all about the exits at the end, which tend to be when you defer and you go into more projects that don't give you cash flow. They tend to be a little bit more safer, and they tend to give you bigger whacks of equity gains at the end. Maybe I'll give a specific example here. So if you look at multifamily value add class C deals or class B deals, all you're really trying to do in that business plan is to bump the net operating income by 20%. That's the name of the game. When you bump the net operating income by 20%, for those of you guys who understand the everybody should understand the simple concept of how much these properties are evaluated, which is a net operating income divided by the prevailing cap rate, and that's the market price. Now, the prevailing market cap is a little bit outside of everybody's control, but generally over time, it tends to stay steady or maybe even go down in a upward moving market. But in these business plans, what we're trying to do is increase the net operating income by either increasing the income, which is bumping rents, or decreasing or keeping the expenses the same. That's what increases the NOI over time. So these deals where you're trying to double your money in 5 years, multifamily value add, I think a lot of people start out with, all you're trying to do is 20% lift on the net operating income, which is not very much. Whereas other more heavier value add or development deals, that net operating income bump is a lot more heavier. And that's, I think, if I'm trying to illustrate it, that's where the kind of the margin of safety. So maybe you flub on your business plan and you're not able to sell it for as high. Maybe you still increase the net operating income by a lot more. Whereas if you're in a multifamily value add deal where you're trying to bump the NOI by 20% and you only get 10% bump in your NOI, then you can see like that margin of safety is a lot smaller on that. And now you can see why more higher level investors, they see it more in terms of, all right, what business plan isn't going to be executed 100% all the time? Which one has the larger factor of safety there? It's just something to think about because I think it is a little bit counterintuitive from investors where newer investors will focus in on getting cash flow today as a way to de-risk their investment. But in reality, the cash flow that you get before the value add plan is cashed in and sold is very menial in the grand scheme of things. Here are some major factors I think it would be good for everybody to highlight. And we're going to be going into these in a little bit more in detail coming up. But I would say this would be a good thing for everybody to take note or copy on your own into your own little notebook. It used to be back in the day, 2016, in the golden era of apartment investing, that, and I'm sure that point will come back. Who knows? Maybe that 2016 equivalent will be in 2024, 25, right? Because 2022 and 2023 were really difficult years where some market evaluations came down 30%, but things go up and down. And back in the day, 2016, in the good times, you were able to get 50% of your returns through cash flow. So you'd be seeing deals that you could get 8, 9, 10% cash flow paid quarterly, and you also double your money at the end at the exit, way ahead of time. Obviously, a lot of that is due to market appreciation, maybe half of it, but that's probably as good as you're going to ever see it. And other times, it's a little bit less. But you just need to understand when the tops are. Easier said than done, of course, right? Like you never know when the top is, and most likely it's a false top. And if you're like most people who just sit on their hands and not do anything out of fear, you're gonna lose out on 2018, 2019, 2021, some great years. So my advice is to never assume that you can time the market and to play it more from a perspective of dollar cost averaging. And to build a bridge of 4 to 6 years of consistent investing so that when the top does happen and you invest in the wrong part of the market cycle because nobody knows, you have 4 to 5 years of good deals that are totally safe and can bridge that. And I think that unless your net worth is over $4 to $5 million, you don't have the liberty to be doing safer, risky or free investments. And you have to play in the arena of 14 to 15% IRR type of investment deals to realize the net worth growth and the tax advantages of this alternative investment world. So it's the necessary evil is what I'm saying. So the basis of a lot of these alternative investment deals is forced appreciation. There's two types of appreciation, market appreciation and forced appreciation. Market appreciation is dumb luck. It's when your buddy who buys a house in the Bay Area for 600K back in 2019 and it goes up to $850,000 a year later. It's what I say, easy come, easy go. And if you can get lucky on it, yeah, cash out, refi, sell the property because it will obviously be evened out However, the nice thing about real estate is typically goes up over time. That's due to inflation. In a way, I think that's why a lot of investors stick with real estate because it tends to follow inflation and is known as a good inflation hedge. But what we're trying to do in these types of alternative investment world is to go off of force appreciation. So what that means is adding value to the asset. And to get away from this esoteric talk, what does it mean? Increase income or decrease expenses? So basically driving your net operating income up, which is income minus expenses. And here's a myriad of different ways that can be done that are time tested. If you read through these types of things, you start to realize, wow, these things are actually pretty dang basic. And yeah, that's the essence of real estate. And that's why, I don't claim to be a super smart guy. Real estate is a very forgiving investment for basic business operators. The business doesn't change very much. At the end of the day, it's just renting out livable boxes to individuals. So back in 2021, just to give a very extreme example, assets in Phoenix were trading for 3.5 cap rate. And we're talking Class B assets, because based on what assets you are in or the class ABC, there's obviously a range. And then obviously different asset classes like self-storage, industrial, multifamily have their different cap rate ranges too. But if we're talking apples to apples, Class B, multifamily, Phoenix, trading for 3.5 to 4, that's a prevailing cap rate. And a year later, due to interest rates increasing and no buyers in the market and in total market shift, you saw those same cap rates go up to 6%, meaning that due to the cap rates increasing like that, the market price went down by 30% about. So that's where it's a little bit different than residential real estate. Residential real estate is based off of comparable sales, what your neighbor bought the property for, whereas commercial real estate is based off of the numbers, which is net operating income, which is what the property is performing at, divided by the prevailing cap rate. And when that prevailing cap rate goes from 3.5% to 6, you guys can play around with the numbers. What I play around with, just let's say $500,000 a year, and then the cap rate is 3.5%. That is a property that is worth 14 million. But if the cap rates go up to 6%, now it's worth 8.3 million. So that's where you can see how you calculate the market price of these properties. So that's an example of market appreciation. Just that's what's out of your control. And that's why you say it's kind of luck. I always say luck is opportunity and preparation. You obviously want to have the sales up in the down periods so you can ride that market appreciation. We've seen it help us in the past. We picked up a more of a Class C plus property in Atlanta. We bought it. I think 18, we sold it in 2000. Now we have picked up 17. It was less than a 3-year hold, and we like more than doubled investors' money on that. And I would like to say it was due to our forced appreciation, which it was, but a big part of that was market appreciation, I will admit.
Hey, Lane, on a situation like that, the cap rate changes. So basically, everything else being the same, it's just a matter of just holding the property until it reverts back, right?
That's correct. And as I've learned, and a lot of these lessons are created in blood, if you have fixed rate debt, you're fine. However, if you've got floating debt or your debt is coming up for renewal, you have a shorter term, that's a tricky situation. And I think this is one piece of due diligence investors need to understand. And that may not be a game killer, right? If the projections on a deal is to double your money in 2 or 3 years and it's using floating debt, then that reward is good. And you may be okay taking more risks. You may put this in your head as part of an asymmetric part of your portfolio. And that's a tactic that a lot of high net worth people do. I'm actually thinking about playing around with some venture capital, which you lose money most of the time, but you make a killing 10, 20, 30x your money, right? And it's all kind of the averages of your portfolio. But I think most investors, they want to stay within the lines a little bit of regular. And although there is no regular in this world, that makes it difficult. There's two layers to that. So floating debt, if interest rates go up, your debt service could easily double or triple. And that will put a huge strain and evaporate your cash flow. And it'll evaporate your reserves. And then in addition to it, the big deal killer is at some point your loan will come up for renewal. A lot of those floating debt deals, the ranges on when the loan comes up for renewal is about a year to a few years, meaning that in a year or a few years, whenever the loan comes up for reset, wherever the market appreciation or depreciation is, you may have to come in with a cash in refinance. And passive investors may not be able to come up with that money at that time. So that's a big risk. But let's not look at the downsides of floating debt, right? There are good things about it. And in a upward increasing market, you can really magnify returns. I think most people listening will be like, nah, I don't want that, right? Like, I'm totally fine just doubling my money every 5 years or, but I think what investors will do is once they start to see a lot of deals, you start to become a little jaded, and then you don't really invest in deals unless it shows you like double your money in 5 years. And that may not be reasonable out there if you're going into fixed rate debt deals or deals with longer loans on them. This is what separates newer investors who don't really look at this thing that we're talking about here. And so the next part, so on top of floating debt, you can still have fixed rate debt deals. But the problem with some of those are your loan resets are might be anywhere from, like I said, a year to 5 years or less. I feel is a little bit, you might want to consider that. Or I'm not saying any deal is a bad deal. This is not black and white. This is very gray. You as an investor need to understand and take your own due diligence and say, hey, does this make sense as a deal? Does this make sense as a deal for my particular part of my big personal portfolio? And so, like when we would go in for a fixed rate debt deal, we always have options. And normally we'd be presented with a 3 year note, a 5 year note, a 7 year note, a 10 year note, different time horizons. This is just my particular opinion. I feel like most market cycles last about 7 to 10 years from your peak to trough. Therefore, if you're going in with a fixed rate debt loan package of 5 to 7 years, that's typically enough for you to bridge the gap if you were oh so lucky of investing and then a year goes by and then the bottom drops out, right? Now, some people would say you need more, but there's a trade-off in this. The longer you go, 7 year, 8 year, 10 year loan, the higher interest rate you pay. And this is something that investors need to understand. This is the shades of gray. There's always a trade-off. Now, we're still playing in the world of fixed rate debt. So you've taken that risk off the table of of interest rates going up and your debt service going up. Still, you could be in a situation with a fixed rate debt deal where it's 3 years and you go into that deal in 2020. Things are going great, awesome. But in 2023, in the bottom of the market, you have to come up with a cash in refinance because the market evaluations came down. And maybe the loan to values that the banks are giving loans out aren't 70% anymore, but they are 50% more. So you have to bring a lot more money to the table on an asset that is a lot less where your equity evaporated. This is what's called a cash in refinance. It is the opposite of a happy cash out refinance. You may have to bring in a few million, $5 million to the table. Depends on how big the deal is. Of course, it's on the deal level. So each investor may have to bring in 50%, 150% of additional capital to the table just to get a loan because your loan came up for renewal 3 years later. Now, is 5 years the right number? Maybe, right? It's better than three. And that's if you're understanding, if I'm trying to convey like where my head is at with this. And every fixed rate debt deal, I get asked, well, what do we want to do here? I usually like playing it somewhere in the middle of 5 to 7 year time horizon. Again, you go the longer time horizon, you're going to pay a lot more in interest rate costs there. That's a very important one. Investors understand the debt scenario. We'll say investors are like, oh yeah, that makes all sense to me. I'm just going to do a fixed rate debt deal with a really long time horizon. I'll tell you, buddy, you ain't going to find many deals that do that out there. So this is just to understand the business a little bit, to put together a syndication, real estate, venture capital is pretty expensive. I usually go with a general rule of 20 grand, but there are obviously a lot more costs that I think general partners will float in the interim that is ultimately paid through acquisition fees at the end of the day. And there, of course, there's all this payroll that needs to be done in a true real estate private equity company. But yeah, this business isn't cheap, that's for sure. And that's where the syndicator makes money, ideally to pay for all these types of fees and to build a pay the team. And I think that's what separates your one-off syndicators who are still working their day jobs that you probably don't want to invest with, that are probably in one of these multifamily boot camps where they train them up in 1 weekend and everybody's jumping on the same deal as key principals because everybody's net worth is like half a million and you need 15 of these guys to get a $7 million loan. This is what happens on the lower rungs. I've gone through this and all the money that you make through these deals as a syndicator, to me, just a business to 101 should be going to building the business, building the team, and salaries and building businesses take money. And yeah, I see some people, they still work their day jobs and they supplement with their W-2 and they can take these fees and live on it. But I don't know, that's fine for them. I'm not going to invest in unprofessionals. I want to invest in professionals. And what I mean by professionals are people who make this their full-time day job, or at least people who've done $500 million of assets under ownership. You hear a lot of people who say, yeah, we never had a capital call. We never had a bad project, but they've only done like $250,000, $300,000 of deals. And so, yeah, you've only done 6, 10 projects. What can go wrong really in that many projects? But when you start to get to 20, 30, 40 projects, then shit's going to go down at some point. So this is something where I think passive investors pay a little bit way too much attention to it. But I understand why. It's because most passive investors don't understand really any of the stuff that we were talking about earlier. What is the debt structure? What are the risk rewards there of using floating debt or sub 5 year loan terms? And they focus on things that they can see and are really visible. And this is the fee structure. It's if you guys stepped into a director role at work and now you're managing other crafts or trades or people who worked in different avenues, it's if you don't know what they're doing, like now you have an accountant on your team and you're an engineer. I don't know what the heck that accountant does because I never did that work. You don't give that guy too much of a hard time. But you really give your engineers a really hard time because you did that job and you know what it is. And whether it's right or wrong, that's the reality of it. And I think that's what passive investors, they understand these fees, but I think most times it can be very misleading and it really is a red herring, I think. Normally these fees are 1 to 3% as a kind of an industry normal for semi non-institutional investors. So I'll define what that is. Institutional operators are people who've done several $1 billion assets under ownership. You have a huge team. You probably have a payroll of over $500,000 per year. You're also not going to get the return. You're not going to double your money in 5 years with these guys. It's more like double your money in 10 years, or they give you some BS infinite return thing that you hear out there that is really, we just haven't realized an end for this investment, and that just justifies our sub 10% return annually. That doesn't make any sense to you. Maybe I'll do another video on that some other time. But a lot of these institutional firms will, they have to charge a lot of fees to pay the salary. I've talked to another operator. They have a payroll of $1 million, $2 million a year, and they have to do deals to keep the lights on, which we would think allows them to source better deals and more professional staff. But at some point, now you get into this world of just too much bloat. And I think I always feel like there's somewhat of a median in the middle. You, of course, don't really want to invest with operators that are under $500 million assets. That's just a newbie status. I think at this point, we've got like $2 billion of assets. So we're in the middle there. But some of these institutional operators will charge maybe 2% on the acquisition fee, but have all these other fees, which is a tricky way of them to hide their fees. But really, what I would do is just add that into the acquisition fee. They may have acquisition fee 2%, funding fee 1%, loan guarantor fee 1.5%, and marketing fee 0.5%. I don't know if you do the math, but that's The way I look at that, oh, that's like a 5-6% acquisition fee there. Take it for a grain of salt. May not be that they're not worth it, but just understand that. Don't get duped into being misled there. Asset management fee, this is a lot smaller than acquisition fee because it's based off the income the asset produces, and it's normally between 1 and 3%, and it's made to give the operator a little bit of small cash flow stream to pay for the asset management team to, go to the project, oversee the project from remotely. You can't just expect your operator just get paid at the end as carried interest. That's just not fair, but these are the normal ranges. And then a distribution or exit fee at the end. Sometimes you see this zero. I just put here normally 1 to 3%. Development fees. So normally they'll tack on in development deals or heavy value add deals. You'll have a certain percentage of fees associated with the construction costs alone, which is a lot smaller than the asset price pickup. So this may be 5 to 20%, but it's on a lot smaller scope. The acquisition 1% on $20 million, for example, the development fees might be 10%, but if you only have $1 million of construction, you do the math, it may be a lot smaller and doesn't move the needle as much, even though the sticker shock, see 10% just development fees. But yeah, as I said here, just because the fee structure is high, this doesn't just disqualify. This is all the take everything with a grain of salt. It's important to understand this stuff. Some investors, some operators, I might recommend to some of our higher net worth family office clients, even though that they're getting killed with acquisition fees, but because it's a reputable operator that's been around for a while. Of course, like I said, you're not going to double your money in 5 years. It's more of a double your money in 10 years, but the reliability is going to be a little bit stronger than working with somebody under $1 billion of assets. Other fees in there, you have real estate brokerage fees. This is all kind of standard stuff, but it's disclosed in the PPM, and that just goes out to the, these are normal transaction costs. Same thing with the property management fees. Normal ranges are 3 to 6% in larger scale commercial assets. This is a pass-through, goes right to the property management. I think a lot of us are used to paying 8 to 10% of the rents with little single family homes, a lot cheaper here. There's some expenses, reimbursements, like legal fees and stuff like that. It seems like it's ticky-tack, right? But these things just need to be disclosed in the PPM. And at the end of the day, the projections, they should be, I'm not going to say all the time, but they should be very simply just taken into account what the fees are. So that's why I'm like, in a way, don't really worry about what the fees are. If the projections are at and some of these things that we talked about are conservative and underwritten the right way, that's really all that matters. And in the end of the day, maybe that's just my perspective. You may not agree with it. You're going into a deal and the projected returns based off reasonable assumptions. And it's your job as the investor to make sure if they're reasonable. And let's try this out. If it works, if it doesn't, what were the market conditions outside of our control that were failed, and you as the investor have the option to invest with the sponsor the next time. That may not fly with you in your head, but that's to me, welcome to the alternative investment world. We are adults here, and this is how it works. Of course, by meeting other investors, you can expedite this a lot, and that's why we say your network is your net worth. But unfortunately, how this world is played. And there are like review sites out there, but they're all like messed up where all the operators know what the review sites are. You just pay them off and you get your good reviews on there. So that's, again, very misleading. And that's why I always say, yeah, meet other real passive investors and you should build relationships with them at the end of the day. Even if when I first started out, you invest with some losers and maybe even some unscrupulous people, but you start to get better. And over time, when you diversify, I think you realize that this does work, and you're going to wish you had a network of other cool people to invest alongside her. So another thing investors key in too much on is preferred rate of return. All this means is investors are going to receive this first. Investors, obviously, they like this because they're like, this puts me in front of the operator. If the operator wants to eat or get paid, they're going to at least hit this hurdle, preferred rate of return. Sometimes the preferred rate of return can be that's what you're paid, and then you're paid a back-end split after that. Sometimes it's cumulative. So I'll explain that a little bit more in detail. So say your preferred rate of return is 10%. So the first 10% that the investor makes gets eaten by the passive investor. And then maybe the back-end split is 50-50 after that. So if there's 20% of returns, the 10% goes to the investor, the remaining 10% gets split amongst the GP and LP. So 5%, 5%. If it's cumulative and it is a 70-30 split, cumulative 70-30 split, sure, the passive investor gets paid first, the preferred returns, but that remaining 10%, which is a cumulative 20% we're talking about, gets paid based off of that 70-30 split. So 14% goes to the passive investor. The remaining goes to the general partner, if that makes sense. So it's cumulative. Again, if you're more of a high-level person, like, who just looks at things on a 5-year time horizon, preferred rate of returns are nice, but who cares? We're all in it to when the deal exits anyway, right? When we can cash in on that value add pop at the end. I'm just bringing this up because, again, some investors aren't super sophisticated, so they focus in on things that they can quantify in their head, which is the fees and the preferred rate of returns. And then I hear about these things all the times and all these really basic internet forums out there. Oh, so and so is good because their preferred rate of returns are like 12%. Yeah, that's a good pref, but dude, that has nothing to do about the deal. That's like saying my car is awesome because it's red. Yeah, well, red's a cool color, but what freaking car did you get? What deal are you going to? What deal assumptions are they doing to get the numbers that they're projecting? That's what I'm saying. Preferred rate of returns are considered waterfalls, or hurdles is another term. So once you hit a certain waterfall, it goes down to a different type of split. I prefer, as a passive investor, just real simple, one split the whole way, as opposed to all these games where it's hurdle one, hurdle two. Typically, the general partner is the smartest people in the room. So they're always going to cook it where the general partner is going to get paid when the deal goes really well. And I don't know. This is just my philosophy. I think it's more fair if the passive investors are coming in, then they should get equal amount of the upside. But for some higher net worth investors, I can see where they just give me my 15%, 20% a year, and I'll be on my way. If the deal gets knocked out of the park, awesome. That's more motivation for the general partner to more safen my investment throughout the years and hold. So again, you look at it both ways, shades of gray. And now you can see where this is getting a little complicated. And you have these different, we call these capital stacks, right? So normally you have, let's go to this image here since it's the easiest. And you have to get the money to buy an asset. So the biggest thing I think people understand is you have this layer of debt, which is the senior, can be a bank, can be an insurance company lending money, can be just a debt fund. So they'll typically come in with the largest amount of the capital, 50%, 70% of the capital, and the rest needs to be come up from the syndication partnership. If you've ever bought a house before, consider this sort of like the down payment and the CapEx money that you need. But to complicate things further, in our world, that down payment is going to be coming up from multiple people in different classes. Or this could be very simple. It could just be one class. It could just be the general partner class, or it could just be just a simple LP class. But where you start to add in complications is preferred equity layers, which sit on top of the class limited partner, common equity class, and then obviously on top of the general partner class. So you can have different deals structured different ways. Some investors from a passive level, again, take the approach of like, all right, sounds interesting. Doesn't really matter. What are the things I need to look at in the underwriting to spot check it? But sometimes there's a little bit of devils in the details. Sometimes I'll look at a deal and I'll see like, all right, who's this other class A preferred equity investor? What other additional terms did they write into it? And so it's a little bit devils in the details, but this goes well beyond the scope of a passive investor. So unless anybody has any questions here, we'll move on and not get caught up in the details. So also say, like, I saw preferred rate of returns prefs typically are good for passive investors. I've seen it can also go really bad too, and this is an extreme case. So I've seen a deal where the sponsor, they had a big pref on it, like 15%. That's a really big pref. And they're in a deal, and the deal kind of just got stalled out, and time went by. And just to use the math easy, 3 years went by and nothing really happened. No returns. There was nothing. the pref is still ticking. Because the pref is, again, what we call the 15% a year. So 15 times 3, 45%. So that means if the deal got sold at 45% return, the sponsor, general partner, would have made no money out of it. And this obviously does not fall in the realm of fiduciary, but the money has, the way the deal was structured, the general partner is going to do what the general partner is going to do. And this is where it's important to invest with people that have a good honor system and do the right thing. But what happened was general partner sold the deal to somebody else and just paid off investors, even though the deal really had upside and was probably going to hit maybe eight double that a year later. But because the general partner wasn't going to make money, they weren't motivated to do it. So that's always obviously messed up, right? And it's very rare, but it illustrates the point of this is a partnership at the end of the day. Passive investors are somewhat of a commodity. Passive investors, they typically want to get anywhere from 10 to 20% return per year at the end of the deal. Sponsors, general partners are taking on a lot of risks. This is their full-time profession. Sometimes it seems very lucrative in good times, but sometimes it can be very lean. And both sides, there is a happy middle ground in the middle. And I always feel like everybody needs to make money. It's just like when I was a construction manager, and I had to manage a contract for our owner, and we had a contractor there. And the way I saw it is, look, you and I can make our lives a living hell, or we can both work together, and you need to make a fair return for you and your company. And I'm here not to have my owner get hit up by all these change orders. And maybe that's just my outlook on a lot of things is let's all work together and sing kumbaya. Same thing with general partners and LP. There's a fair medium where everybody's paid and everybody's making money and happy. And let's just do this a lot more times together and let's make a lot of money. I would rather have a little scoop of the watermelon than have all of the grape is a saying that comes to mind. So when you look at splits and fees, you need to also have your general partner motivated to make money. And at the end of the day, this is a JV agreement. And this is outside of real estate deals. This is just when me making deals with different vendors or different non-real estate partners. My goal is to structure that agreement where everybody's motivated and everybody's making money and everybody's pulling in the right direction. And this is that attitude and mindset, I think, is really no different in this type of world. Some investors will be like, I only invest in deals that are 80-20 split. You're not going to find any good operators who are going to want to do that for you, but you're going to get really bad operators that are desperate. But that's just, there's a fair split out there, I believe. I also talked to some operators that do, they give their investors like a measly 5% pref, but then take majority of the upside after that. I think that, I don't know, that's a more vague extreme example on that end too, where it might be a little bit too much gouging, but hey, they do very small deals and they don't need to raise that much capital. And you know what? If the passive investors are happy, the passive investors are happy for all I'm concerned. Oh, norm skin in the game from general partners. That's another thing that I think investors will look at is like, all right, I like this whole thing because general partners have skin in the game over. It can be very misleading. And again, it comes down to what kind of operator you're working with. If you're working with an institutional operator, they ain't putting no skin in the game. They have the track record. They don't need to put down money. On the other side of it, if you're working with somebody on their first deal, shoot, I want to see them come up with like half of the money, like 50% of the capital raise, which obviously if they're new, they're probably not going to have a net worth of higher than $2 million. So that's impossible. I think if you're talking about operators under $1 billion of assets under ownership, you hear about a rule of the 10% rule where you want 10% of the capital coming from the general partner. So if a capital raise is $5 million, 500 grand. But then again, if you're doing a deal where you need $15, $20 million of capital, that's $2 million. And that's just not really practical. Some people talk about this lying game where that's going on, where, as I've alluded to, passive investors, if they're going by strictly by that 10% rule, it's a little ridiculous. It's being a syndicator, it is really ridiculous. I'm not going to have $2 million sitting on the sidelines to throw in as an LP role. I'll put in some money, but not $2 million. To counteract this, it's a little dirty secret in the syndication world. You throw in the acquisition fee that may supplement to get to that 10% number. Some institutional passive investors will just have this on their checklist, whether it's 5%, 10%, and just check the box on it, not really do too much due diligence into it. I guess what I'm telling investors here is, yeah, you want to have your general partner to have skin in the game. However, do understand that they also are signing on the debt in most cases, and that to me is a bigger, much, much bigger risk. They ain't going to be going nowhere, and they're backing the loan at the end of the day, so passive investors don't have to put in their name. Do understand the spectrum of operators, right? Like, it's funny, like a lot of these investors that don't go to this e-course, don't listen to the words I'm saying, going real black and white, and they're like, I didn't invest in a deal because the operator did not put down 10%. How big was the capital raise was $15 million, and I wanted to see him put in 1.5. Like, that's absurd, buddy. But that's just how some people are. And then what they do is they turn around, they go invest with the brand new guy on the capital raise, which was the second deal that an operator did, which is a 4 million capital raise where they put in 400 grand, but they're complete newbies. They put in 400 grand because they're a bunch of doctors trying to be real estate investors because they went to a weekend boot camp. I'm just that's a obvious, silly example, but that's what people do in this world. And that's, again, shades of gray here. Don't be like these guys. And this is what you in a lot of these internet forums out there with this just a lot of kind of absurd advice. I just watched the Little Mermaid. If the in the beginning scene, Ariel takes the fork to that one kooky seagull. She's like, what's this fork to the seagull? And the seagull looks at it and he's like, what's that? And he says, oh, I know what this is. It's a comb to comb your hair. And that's a little bit what you get some of these internet forums where like I see people like typing justifications for certain things. Oh, the operator's doing it like this. I'm like, no, man, you got it completely wrong. That fork, that's a fork. Use that to eat food, not comb your hair. A lot of these internet forums, you just have the blind leading the blind. You have some outspoken investor that, or the seagull that kind of thinks that they know what they're doing. And then a bunch of the lemmings just following the guy because he's a little bit outspoken in the group. Here's an example I was talking about earlier. You can have at a certain flip point or hurdle. This is common where you'll have a different split here. Any questions on splits fees? Like I said, it's not super important, but it always like you guys always love to talk about it. You guys feel free to come off mute, or type it in. There's a discussion here on preferred rate of return, like what we're talking about, not to be confused with preferred equity sits on top of the capital stack of the common equity investors and you get paid less. However, when the deal struggles or there's difficult times, now you realize why some sophisticated investors choose to do preferred equity more in the right situation. A lot of Q&A in here to read through, and I put this at the end so that investors have a good understanding and kind of take things with a grain of salt. But then I hit you with all the details here. This is that cap rate formula I was talking about earlier, the net operating income divided by the current market. Well, actually, this one's flip-flopped around. The current net operating income divided by the current market asset is the cap rate, but really you want to see the formula where NOI divided by cap rate equals the current market value. That's how the properties are evaluated. If you've never done it before, I think it is a good exercise to play around with some of these calculations just to get a play on how that simple calculation that we just went over works. But the takeaway from that is, wow, there's some magic in this multifamily investing thing where if I'm able to bump the rents, that's how now I understand how we're able to double our money in a lot of these types of projects. However, where you're not investing in a static world and there are some unknowns and those knowns are cap rates do move around and they are very tied with interest rates. But that as an investor, this is what you're trying to do. You're trying to make a spread on the borrowing rate and what your assets make. There is always a little bit of a delta. Sometimes it scrunches down and those are ideally in hindsight, the worst times to invest. Sometimes it's a little bit wider. I would probably say right now it's a little bit wider, but then you apply leverage and that's how you make a nice return. And that's the investment name of the game for investors. You can see those scrunch points here a little bit. Obviously, 2020, great time to invest, right? Times are fearful. That's when you invest. Cap rates differ from market to market. So what we're going to go into now is when a syndicator puts out a deal, they're going to obviously market it you should know what they're using for their assumptions for prevailing and exit cap rates. And obviously, an investor, you should probably know on my own what the cap rates are, but it's rather difficult for LPs because cap rates range very differently from market to market. San Francisco is going to be a lot lower than your Dallas. And then even from there, it ranges. This is just one snapshot in time. And then from asset to asset class, self-storage to multifamily to office. And then also, even if it was just multifamily class ABC, there's a range there. Okay, so this is the most important thing. And I think we'll end with this. Your exit cap rate, to me, this is the biggest thing that you manipulate on the spreadsheet as an operator to fudge your numbers. So there's a cell on the spreadsheet. I think I have it here, but the cell on the spreadsheet where you project, well, you take a wild ass guess, right? What is the exit cap rate or the reversion cap rate is another term used for this, where the market will be when you're going to sell. A general rule of thumb for institutional operators and professional underwriters is you increase the cap rate slightly or you keep it the same, right? So if say you're going into a deal where the prevailing cap rate is 4%, it would not be unreasonable for a professional underwriter to use 4% as an exit or anywhere for 4.5. We've traditionally used a little bit double the conservativeness on this, where we might go 5% on that type of prevailing cap rate. And you'll see how much that does change the numbers a little bit. But we don't know what the cap rate is going to exit at. But you can assume that you're selling it into a softer, weaker market in the future. And by doing that, you increase that exit cap rate on that one cell in the spreadsheet. Some people even say that they just say a general rule of thumb, just increase it by 0.5% or 4%. Some people are a little more scientific where they're like, for every year of the ownership of the property, you increase it by 0.1%. So if you have a 5-year deal, that's a 0.5% of an increase. If you have a 10-year deal, you do a 1% of an increase. But where that really matters now, I coined the word cap rate gate previously. So say I was a good conservative Boy Scout underwriter and I increased my reversion cap rate or exit cap rate 1%. And my spreadsheet magically gave me 100% return in 5 years. And that's what they would put on this pitch deck. So investors would be like, all right, cool. 100% return. Awesome. But what if another operator wasn't as much of a Boy Scout and they fudge the numbers and just, let's just only increase it by 0.5%. Now the returns would go up, as you can see. So what if this also works the other way? And this is probably the case that I'm talking about for past investors to be very aware of. Sure, you might have a return in 5-year deal, but you don't know what the reversion cap rate differential they're using. So obviously, if I were to interpolate here, you might have a spread of 50% return. So meaning, say their pitch deck with all their fees that we talked about that now you're seeing are complete meaningless in a way. And even if you have a no fees, who cares if the deal is underwritten poorly? And this is just one thing I'm talking about here. So you have 100% return on your pitch deck, but the operator is not assuming for any increase in the reversion cap rate. They're assuming that the market will stay absolutely the same. What I would do is I would look at that deal and it's like, all right, that's cool, but I'm going to normalize it to assume that there is an increase in a reversion cap. And therefore, your 100%, I'm going to redline that in my head and be like, it's more like a 50% return in 5 years. And will I invest at that point? Maybe. And I think this is what happened in hot markets where you have operators showing 100, 120% return in 5 years. And investors say, yeah, cool. But people don't really dig into the numbers and realize it's risky or it's not really conservatively underwritten to get to that point. But this is the cat and mouse game, I think, with past investors and operators. Right? Like somewhere between 80% or lower, past investors will not invest, which is a shame because it could be a really good deal where, yeah, you may not make that much money, 80%. If the market goes really well, you can make double that. But I think, at least speaking for myself, I want to know at least I won't lose money and get 10% a year. But that's not the reality. Everybody is hiking their skirts up a little bit. I'm playing around with numbers to be competitive. And when you're in these incredibly competitive circles, it can be a bit of a downward spiral competition. But I would say this is, we'll end here. I'll open up for any questions that you guys have to close out. But this is probably the biggest thing, I think. If you know this, this is probably half of everything you need to know. That and understanding the debt package that you're going into, which is essentially the business plan. But definitely, I think when I first started to do it, I would just take a look at pitch decks and see where they were with their version cap differential. And that would give me an idea of, the rest of the package. It's like you have a tenant and you check out their car. Is it dirty, clean? Is there Burger King wrappers on the dashboard? It can give you an indication and sense on how things are done in the shop from an underwriting perspective. But yeah, any other last questions before we get going here?
Thanks, Lane. I think for me, my takeaway is basically, again, probably the best indicator would just be past performance to some extent, other than the numbers that they're showing.
Yeah, to a certain extent. I look at all the operators who have been around. A lot of them got started in 2015, and that was, you could be an idiot and you could make money. Maybe call me one of those two. But after a certain point, you cross over to institutional investor status and you start to build a team, and those principals fade off and they hire professionals to take over. Then you got to do deals just to do deals. They pay the payroll. And sure, they might have exited the deals previously with high returns, but the new current generation of deals are with a totally different split scheme, a different fee scheme, and more importantly, different underwriting scheme. When they first got it started, maybe they were doing a 1% differential, but now they're doing it the way that institutional operators do it with maybe none or worse. I won't say who it is, but some of those guys are actually going negative on that reversion cap rate, saying that the market that they're investing in is an upward moving market, sub-market. And I'm like, no, I don't buy that. But that's just what they do, right? So there's a trade-off. Will they steal your money? No. And that's a pro from going down that angle. At least they've done this in the past. But yeah, that's my addition to the takeaway there. It's tough. That's what makes this tough, right? And in a way, I'm making you guys second guess each other on purpose, even especially some of you guys who've been investing for a while now. But if there's one thing I know, at the end of the day, we're investing in things that will be around for 5, 10 years plus, and you stay on board on those types of investments where there's a fundamental growing need for it, like the whole Warren Buffett value investing thing, and you invest in with good, honest people. And you start to get to a diversified portfolio of dozen, couple dozen plus deals, you should be okay. And you should realize there's this concept here, right? And this is more talking about fixed rate floating debt, but like this image here is what I'm trying to talk about. The less deals you have, the more variability you have. But the more deals you have, the more cracks you have at it, the less variability you'll have. Also, the return will be lower, but that's where I'm saying, like, calibrate your expectations to it. This road of alternative investments is still better than traditional investments. You just have to go through the growing pains that I think a lot of new investors go through initially. And you are going to be a bit exposed in the beginning from a diversification standpoint until you get to a dozen, couple dozen deals. And that's just going to take time and uneasiness.
Hey, Lane, one question I did have was, do you have any resource recommendations for investors to determine prevailing cap rates across markets and asset classes?
Oh yeah, good question. I talked about that earlier, but I didn't answer it. But yeah, say you're looking at, okay, I'm looking at a deal in Dallas, 1970s build, so that's like Class C. Here's the problem, I think, for past investors, and I'm gonna tell you may not like this answer, but you're going beyond the scope of a past investor, buddy. I think if you're able to get a lot of pitch decks, maybe like several dozen, you can see trends on what prevailing cap rates people are using, but nothing really changes talking to brokers. And honestly, I know what they are, but I'm always going to go off of what a broker tells me because they're the ones who have their ears against the floor. And especially in volatility times like right now, I'm going to be off by 0.5%, maybe even 1%. That said, from an LP's perspective, you don't need to get it right on the gnat's ass, right?
Sure.
you can be plus or minus a percent. But I think as long as you see that prevailing cap rate differential different, that's the key here with that
Got it.
reversion cap rate. But yeah, people in our family office group, I always tell them, yeah, if you're give me the market, like how we have here, give me the asset. Is it multifamily? Is it industrial? Give me the approximate age of the property so I can figure out what class of property, ABC. And I'm pretty confident I can get it within a quarter percent for them. But if you don't have that access to somebody who can tell you that or a broker, I wouldn't even worry about it, man.
Okay, so there's a lot
You
of
know.
subjectivity to it and not necessarily required for where we're at and what we're talking about today.
Yeah, for now, for a new investor, right? More than some of the best, the average investors out there are current investors at this point, just by understanding this concept. A lot of it as a past investor is understanding the variability and the shades of gray of this. You're not going to be an underwriting specialist. And I think if you're a newer investor, especially like a lower net worth investor, you spend your time doing this type of stuff. I would say spend your time making more money. Just make more money, man. Because after a while, you don't really worry about this type of stuff once you find the jockeys to invest with. But I like that you're asking these right questions because these questions are coming from you understand the concepts, and that's what I'm more about.
Okay, thanks, Lane.
All right. Thanks, everybody.